We're excited to tell you about Pine Tree Garden Seeds, a women-run, family-owned and operated business since 1979, founded with the simple mission of offering low prices on quality seeds to the home gardener. Over the years, offerings have expanded to include over 1,300 varieties of seeds, including many heirlooms and organics, a huge assortment of tools and gardening gear, and lots of new gardening books.
They also offer roots, plant starts, and tubers, berry bushes, asparagus roots, onion sets, hops, fig trees, sweet potatoes, dahlias, peonies, lilies, and a whole new selection of fall flower bulbs. Located in Maine, they operate out of a 300-year-old farmhouse and strive to offer the best service and products with a personal touch. They continue to hand-pack more than half of their seeds and rely on their Ballard machine from the 1890s to do the rest.
So order your seeds today from superseeds.com and use the promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's superseeds, SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024.
Fast Forward Productions, The Women Are Speaking.
To me, what's interesting is what is it about the individual consumer that encourages them to change? Because at this point, all the doom and gloom about climate change, that doesn't work. So what is it that connects with someone to want to eat a little bit differently? Is that necessary? I believe yes.
You're listening to the Good Dirt Podcast. This is a place where we dig into the nitty-gritty of sustainable living through food, fashion, and lifestyle.
And we're your hosts, Mary and Emma Kingsley, the mother and daughter founder team of Lady Farmer. We're sowing seeds of slow living through our community platform, events, and online marketplace.
We started this podcast as a means to share the wealth of information and quality conversations that we're having in our world as we dream up and deliver ways for each of us to live into the new paradigm, one that is regenerative, balanced, and whole.
We want to put the microphone in front of the voices that need to be heard the most right now, the farmers, the dreamers, the designers, and the doers.
So come cultivate a better world with us. We're so glad you're here. Now, let's dig in.
Hello, Emma. Good morning.
I'm thinking a lot about spring cleaning lately, I think, because it's very springy here now. And yesterday I pulled out the entire contents of our coat closet front door situation and strewn it all over the rest of the house, basically. So that's what I'm up to. I'm not sure exactly how that relates to slow living and sustainability, but there's nothing like going through the stuff that you have that helps you curb any kind of shopping or acquiring or feeling like you need to buy things problem that you might have.
This is so true. And different people have different techniques. Maybe you inherited this from me, but that's the way I go about something, a cluttered area, closet, drawer. Take everything out, everything. And then you're staring at this beautiful empty space. For me, I become very discerning about what I'm going to put back in it because I don't want it to look like it did.
Yeah.
That is my way of doing things. And it can be the smallest little space. It can be a small drawer. It can be a giant closet. It can be desktop, cabinet, whatever. That's the way I do it. And I love it. I find it very effective. And the danger is this stuff is strewn out and kind of in the way, but that's motivation to get it out of the way.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm really good at ignoring stuff too, though. So
yeah, stuff does kind of become part of your surroundings. Yeah. And
no, this one, we're a little bit on a deadline because we're going to leave town in a few days. So I'd really like to get it done before we leave town. So that helps. But yeah, I'd had enough. And I thought, I'm going to do this right now.
So this is a coat closet. So are you actually getting rid of the coats or whatever's in there? Are you relocating it?
That's a great point of pause for me, or it's a good pain point in this process because A, we have too many coats. B, some of them are really nice. So we don't wear all of them. So then it's like, do I drive them to Goodwill? Do I try to sell them? Do I try to get them dry cleaned and fixed up nice and offer them around to my friends? You know, it's like there's like so many ways you can handle these items. And so that's kind of where I'm worried about getting stuck. But step one is take them all out and identify them, that they exist, because it's easy to forget about them stuffed in a coat closet. And it's not just coats. This closet has become the catch-all. You know, it's the one just by the front door. So everything gets stuck in there.
Very deep. It goes way back. And so things can go back there and like live for years and you forget about them. I guess you could call it a zone of caution. But it sounds to me like maybe we need to plan a swap. We haven't had one of those in a long time.
Yeah, that would be fun. We should definitely do that.
We have a lot of extra coats and winter things as well that we're not using. I think someone else could make really, really good use of them. So we could do that. You know, we haven't done it in a while.
Yeah, maybe a swap is a good place to start. And then honestly, some of them, like I said, are probably worth selling or reselling, but that's a whole other list of things to do. So that's kind of where I get stuck. So, and then the other part of this that I thought might be interesting to share, something I'm trying, there's this bag, like a purse bag. I'm not a purse person, but really nice bag that I would like to have. I would like to buy it for myself. And I was going to buy it for my birthday, but it's pretty expensive. It's not a designer, super fancy bag or anything, but it's very well made. And it's from a store in Georgetown that I love. And it's French. And I love that. And I love the color. All these things I love about it. And I'm like, I'm going to buy myself this bag. It's a really lovely crossbody. It looks kind of like a fanny pack, but it's big and it's nice looking, can be elevated, can be everyday wear. And I haven't bought it for myself yet. And I thought, you know what I'm going to do first? I'm going to go through both closets, this front coat closet and then my personal closet, and take out all my bags that I have. Again, going back to what I said earlier, there's nothing like immersing yourself in your current items that are overwhelming to you to quell your need for more things. So I'm going to do that first. And if after this process, I still want this bag, or I feel like I'm able to make the space for this bag, and I'm like, I feel like I can buy this, then I'll let myself buy the bag. But I'm going to make myself do this first.
That's great. That's the kind of thoughtful intention that helps us in slow living.
So anyways, moving on to today's episode, we're really excited to introduce it. And we're trying something new this week. And in general, we've realized that a lot of our conversations are very, well, first of all, really great and exciting. And we are so excited to share them. They're also really dense and they're full of so much good stuff. And then the next week, there's another one that's just as dense and full, and it can be a lot. And we've heard from you guys that it can be a lot to feel like you have to catch up on. And we feel ourselves that we are just having amazing conversation after conversation, and they just sort of roll by like a freight train. And so we thought, in an effort to slow it down, we're going to try, for some of these conversations, breaking them into two parts. So this will do a couple of things. It'll make the episode that you're listening to a little bit shorter, which might make it a little easier to get it in as well. And it will also hopefully break it out so that we all have more time between to really let things sink in and stick with us. So starting this week with our conversation with Danielle Schwab, we're going to start with part one, and then next week will be part two. So would you like to introduce Danielle, Mom?
Yes. So our guest today is Danielle Schwab, who founded the platform Illuminate Food in 2020 when it originated as a farm box for delivery in New Jersey. And this was at the beginning of COVID. And now it's a weekly newsletter about how we can better understand our food system and eat for the future. So as you'll hear in this conversation, she is endlessly interested in global supply chains, and she's channeled her interest into food systems, recipe development, and farming.
Danielle uses the lens of food to expose the extractive nature of our global economy and the lack of connection that most of us feel between the food we eat and the people and the land that Gruitt. Her mission is to shed light on global supply chains and the mystery of raw materials and ingredients, where they come from, and how they are produced. She also writes easy recipes based on what you might already have at home.
So in the first of this two-part episode, you'll hear us discussing the complexity of the challenges in both local and commodity-scale production, how consumer choices play a crucial role in driving change in the food system, and the need for more depth in discussions about food sustainability and innovation. And that's exactly why we're talking about it right here on The Good Dirt.
I love this conversation in particular because it actually sort of provided a newer perspective than I think we've had on the show before. And in general, in conversations around food sourcing and the sustainability world and farming, it's a lot of the same conversation about how regenerative farming specifically, and you know, we get so excited about one thing that's going to change everything. And in a lot of ways, that is so true. We're not saying that we don't believe that, but it's just as important to remember that there are so many solutions and so many ways to go about this problem. And we have to from many, many different angles. And I really appreciated Danielle and this conversation in particular for just sort of cracking some of that open. And I'm really excited to share it with you and to begin this conversation here. And I think it's so important that we all remember that it's okay to get off our soapbox once in a while and just listen.
Absolutely. I agree. I love how we have conversations with people that present another way of looking at things. And yeah, it opens up our eyes. It opens up the eyes of all our listeners. And this is what we need to be doing. These are the kind of in-depth conversations. It comes up in this episode how that is what is needed beyond the sound bites that we all see on social media and absorb and take into our lives. It really gets into it a little more. And so yeah, that's one of the reasons why we're dividing this into two parts. It's a very thoughtful conversation. There's kind of a lot to chew in here, pardon the pun. So here's part one of our conversation with Danielle Schwab, creator of Illuminate Foods.
My name is Danielle Schwab, and currently I do two things. I have a job where I work for a mushroom meat company, and I sell that and connect with chefs all over the East Coast. And then I also have a platform called Illuminate Food, which is where I write about sustainable food, climate-friendly recipes, and have a weekly Substack newsletter to cover all these different topics.
Awesome. And how did you get into that? Tell us about mushroom meat. What does that mean?
Yeah. So mushroom meat, pretty much the culmination of a long journey of trying to figure out how to enjoy the work you do and to make a living. So I had a farm box business for a couple of years, which I'm sure we'll get into. Loved everything about that, but ultimately it didn't kind of pay the bills and become a sustainable business for the long term. So I had to kind of make decisions about going back to corporate and consulting and some of the stuff I've done in the past, and ultimately realized I needed a job that I could be with people, be talking to people, and be in the food space. So finding a company that made a product I really believed in, and not only is it just a product, it's something that can replace meat on our plates. And I'm a big flexitarian believer, eat some, whatever you want. So this idea of taking a mushroom and making it the center of your plate really spoke to me. So believed in what they did, and there was an opportunity to kind of keep spreading that message and get more people to taste it so they could put it on menus. It's definitely a long game, but I'm enjoying the work.
That's exciting to me because I am super skeptical of, I don't want to be like super divisive and inflammatory here, but I'm skeptical of a lot of plant-based meats and synthetically developed meats. And also I love mushrooms, and it's so easy to just like put a mushroom on a sandwich and it tastes like you're eating meat. So I think that's brilliant.
It really is. It's, you know, it's a deep psychological, cultural time of transition, and it's going to be a long one. But having that option that is a whole food is where we need to be headed. So it's exactly all of those things. I think people who are really whole food and connected to what they're eating can figure out how to take a mushroom and turn it into something that is satisfying and find their protein or whatever it is. But for a lot of people, have taking it a little bit further and having something that's already kind of prepared and in a texture that is desirable is where they're headed. So right now it's a B2B company. So we're food service only, which is a whole other world of reaching the customer at a restaurant or at their office, catering and events and all of that before we really look to them to cook it at home, because that's actually more difficult to convince someone to try.
Totally. That makes sense.
Wow. Oh, I love the whole world of mushrooms, you know, growing them and eating them. I just think it's very fascinating. And you're right. It's really a wonderful compromise between eating a steak or eating the fake meat, the impossible factory made meat, or whatever they're calling it. And this is something, a wonderful compromise right in between the two that's whole and real, real food.
I also have to say, quick shout out, a girl that I went to school with in Suwanee, Tennessee. She has a restaurant in Suwanee. It's outside Nashville, for anyone who doesn't know. And I was there in the fall, and she had a hen of the woods fried sandwich. It was like a fried chicken sandwich with chicken of the woods mushroom. It was the best thing. I think I ate it 3 times that weekend. It was so good.
There's a guy that lives around here. He's a forager, and every now and then he'll just show up at the door and have this big old pile of hen of the woods and say, you know, would you like some of this? You know, if I can forage on your property, then I'll be glad to give some of this to you. It's so delicious and it's so fresh. And it just speaks of this, you know, the trade economy, the shared economy, that working with the land. I love it so much. So, I'm excited about mushrooms.
Well, I might want to add one thing just to frame the conversation. I think it's so interesting that, you know, part of my like dichotomy and sometimes what feels like an identity crisis is there's mushrooms and foraging, and then there's global commodity production of food and food systems, which is where my background is and what I've always been drawn to. But it's actually so far from the foraging, and it can be difficult because people want to, oh, well, where are your mushrooms from? And do you know your mushroom growers? And it's like, when you start moving away from small scale farms and agriculture, you get to these kind of unidentified large systems at scale that are the opposite of all of that. So it's been interesting to kind of dip back and forth between the worlds, but ultimately my place is with food systems, but it's not as, you know, touchy-feely as foraging and special because it is in Asia. It is large scale, the mushrooms that we're using. And there are some faces behind the production, but it's much more anonymous and commodity scale. So it's always so interesting to kind of be speaking with people that where I also used to be when I had a farm box of this local farm movement, and then also be so far toward the food system level production.
It's an industrialized system that you have to be tapped into in order to do the business you're doing. Like, how else would you supply this to chefs? Oh my gosh, I love this.
Yes. And I want to say that, yeah, we all, you know, we can look on Instagram and admire and learn from the foragers and learn about it, because that just helps facilitate our relationship with the earth and the land and the seasons and all those good things. But there's just too many people on the planet now to forage for our food. We just have to accept that. We're not going to feed ourselves foraging at this point. And so we have to find a way to feed everybody. And at the same time, hopefully move away from the mentality that the USA is going to feed the world. So go big or go home, and all of that stuff that sort of emerged in the last century that has now got us where we are today, which is when we're going to talk a lot about this in this conversation. And we love this stuff. I can't wait to dig into it. But I want to go back before the mushrooms a little bit. And you said you were in the corporate world, and tell us maybe a little bit about what you're doing. And if there was a aha moment or a time or an incident or a story about where you knew that you needed to go in a different direction.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate the question. I think I've had many pivots in my career already, which sometimes feels a little disorienting, but I love to see how different industries work. And I haven't found my home where I've stuck around more than a couple of years, because there's just it's a big world and I've loved every little piece of it that I've been able to work in. But I really was just somebody very interested in global trade. I think early travel in my childhood and just seeing how connected such a global world is brought me to a field of global trade and supply chain. As niche as it sounds, and people are like, what? Global trade and supply chain is how our world is built. It's everything we do. It's kind of the crux of human civilization. So I always see it as, you know, not a niche topic at all. It's actually you know, how our whole lives around us are built. And I always, when I'm talking to someone, just point out something, you know, right in front of me and say, how did this salt even get here? How was the jar made? All of it. It's fascinating to me. So I didn't know what that was going to look like in a career and pivoted to take myself to grad school in Washington, D.C. to study economics, thinking that was kind of, this is how I'll get into it, and wound up with a consulting job that was just so boring to me and cogging the machine and working with big corporations that were doing things I didn't love. And I just felt super stuck. As soon as my career started, I was like, this is awful, because working within global trade and supply chain, you're often just managing it, whether it's inventory management or logistics. There's a lot of jobs. It takes so much effort to pull off what happens every day, but it's not the kind of zoomed out thinking about global trade. It's the gears of the machine. So I was kind of in that world and not loving it and already feeling stuck. And that early pivot from there was, I think, this aha moment of how can I take my love for global trade and bring it a little closer to home? And upon writing and thinking about it, it's like food is that thing that is global trade and at a systemic level, but is also something we participate in every day, multiple times a day. So that to me was this epiphany of, if you can work in food, you can have that connection all day long. So that was it for me. And I've been trying to find my place in food ever since. And I spent some time in a global commodity trading startup that was kind of food, kind of not, and then made my way to basically taking a little life break and driving across the country to visit farms, because I felt, without really seeing it and having an opportunity to talk to people, especially I had so much confusion, organic, regenerative, all these things were buzzing around, and I just wanted to kind of go out there. So in 2020, in February, I was able to kind of carve out a whole year for myself to learn and explore. And I did get to do that road trip in February 2020, which was really lucky, and came home to COVID and just kind of backburnered some of my other plans, and was able to start this farm box just from the ideas of swirling in my mind about farmers I had just met, and also this idea of how to get people more connected to their food. This was like something I felt really strongly about, with how our grocery stores are today and the farmers market being sometimes difficult to get to. I was in New Jersey. There really isn't farmers markets like they are in New York City. So that was the vision, and started small and grew into a company that was able to really have a good run for almost 3 years. We service like 100 something customers a week and deliver what I called kind of an upgraded farm box to their door as a way to just make it easier and also a little more engaged. There was a recipe, there was bread, there was milk, there was eggs, specialty products, all sorts of collaborations and partnerships, and kind of did everything I could to get people excited, because I had friends who have had CSAs and they could feel a little bit like difficult to get through that much produce, a little bit of dread, like, oh my God, my fridge, I don't want to waste. So how do we find something, you know, somewhere in between a meal kit and the CSA was the idea. So that was Illuminate Food. It was a beautiful business. And, you know, after that, it was next kind of led me here.
Tell us how that work. You've explained a little bit of the difference between this and a CSA, but the farm box, explain that and how it was structured.
So it was the same idea as the CSA, where the produce was set for the week. So we would kind of curate, as we said at the beginning of the week, we worked with a regional distributor called Zone 7. So Zone 7 is someone named Michael, and his job, he goes around with the truck to all the local farms and picks it up, because I knew that was something I couldn't do if I wanted to do the other piece of it, the delivery on the other end. So Zone 7 was our main distributor, but only worked with New York and New Jersey farms. And so we would, you know, have the order sheet of what was going to be available the next week. And we would kind of piece together 7 or 8 produce items that we thought went well together. So try and mix it up. And then there was always a recipe as well. So we would coordinate with a chef, or we worked with a various number of people to say, okay, this week we're going to make a frittata. So we would put in the produce items that went with that recipe. And then we sourced eggs directly from Hazelman Farms in New Jersey. And then for bread, we worked with like 5 different bakeries. So we would rotate and order the loaves. And then cheese, we worked with the cheese shop course, the cheese wasn't all local. Sometimes it was, but we had, you know, everybody would get that same piece of cheese every week. So there was this really nice camaraderie in all the customers. They were making the same recipe every week and they were all trying something new every week, whether it was the cheese or whatever bread it was. So it was just what I thought was a special way to get people kind of feel part of something bigger than just opening up a book and making a recipe. So it meant a lot of logistics between coordinating with all these different vendors and getting it delivered. We had a little warehouse that we rented in Paterson, New Jersey. I ended up buying a truck to do the deliveries, which was absolutely the hardest part, getting the routing and the drivers, the snowstorms, the late deliveries. There's always something that goes wrong. And I think at a certain point, it's overwhelming because you have the stuff that goes wrong to get the box together. And then you have the stuff that goes wrong upon the delivery. Even the smallest thing, like people, squirrels kept eating people's bread because we delivered it in a reusable wooden crate, which was so stunning. No packaging, no cardboard, none of that. So it was the reusable crate and we left it. This is a suburb. So we left it on their porch. And then when you drop off the crate, you pick up their empty one. So we were constantly kind of rotating through these beautiful wooden crates, but it meant on occasion, a squirrel, you know, would take
their
bread.
It's like a big welcome sign for a squirrel, like wooden, just like your house. Come on in, eat it.
Yeah. So there was always something, but it's like, it's either that or we're wasting cardboard every week. Like, come on. So it did really work in its heyday. And I think we were able to get people engaged with local produce that would probably not have made the effort to do that because it was more about this delicious thing, this exciting thing, this interesting thing, and less about like, you should do this if you want to be like a good citizen.
So was it a subscription where people would pay ahead and you knew, you know, you had the commitment several months or a year ahead of time?
Yep. So it was a subscription. So they, you know, it was just on a weekly, every Sunday it would charge you for the following Wednesday. So it was difficult to predict. Not very difficult. That's why we did that model, so that we only had to order for as many boxes as we knew we were going to deliver. You know, when I look at the waste or the potential for waste in farmers market, specialty grocer, all of that, I could not handle that. So it had to be that on Sunday, we would see how many subscriptions go through, place the order on Monday for delivery on Tuesday afternoon, for packing it up Wednesday morning, and then hit the road. So it was a very like perfectly timed so that there was never waste. I cannot, waste really bothers me. What I applaud my customers for is it is difficult to order on a Sunday for something that comes on a Wednesday. Now that I cook and meal plan and prep, it's not ideal. Like it is hard to, or not even know what produce you're getting and kind of wing it, like, or not have enough squash for the squash thing you're making. You really are at the whim of somebody else. And ultimately, like, that's why it doesn't work for everybody. And that's why it started to work less as people went back to work and got busier and all of that. So there's a business that ended up kind of acquiring my email list that does what Illuminate used to do, but they're bigger. They can deliver every day. You can modify the produce and you can change up to the day before, you know, certain things that just help make it sustainable for someone in the way that they're feeding their families or themselves. So everybody was really supportive and game to give it a try. And then it kind of had run its course when people just got too busy to not have the most convenient thing, which is often, you know, there was a Whole Foods or whatever it is. And I can't really blame them.
So on Sunday, when you ordered, you didn't know what was coming.
On Sunday, when you ordered, you didn't know. You know, we would send out a very exciting email that was like, we had all these add-ons. So the add-ons were our proteins that we worked with, the local meat and all that. So it would say, here are all these add-ons. And we would say, you know, you're going to get these produce items, but subject to change because everything always changed with harvest and all of that. So we would give them a heads up and ask them to add to their box. Couldn't guarantee it. But if obviously tomato season, you're getting tomatoes, like it did flow quite nicely with the premium stuff from the seasons.
It's amazing how many models there are, how many different versions there are of, like, you know, trying to get people local farm fresh food. You know, of course, we have the CSAs around here. We are members of a wonderful CSA that's full diet year round. We have food co-ops, delivery services.
different things. Also, caveat, and we are in Washington, D.C., so we do have all the options.
It's all there.
It's very cool.
But there's still the common denominator is that
it's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work. And, you know, people really struggle to make a living at this. And it's just so ironic because, you know, food is like, you know, as you said, like food is the common denominator of all humans on the planet.
Yeah. Why is there anything that's more important than food? Like, how is that?
How we got to this place where it's so difficult to get good quality, highly nutritious food. And, you know, this is your life's work. So it's just a fascinating topic. Here are some things we love about Pine Tree Garden Seeds. For one thing, they're lady farmers. It's a woman-owned and woman-run company. 85% of their staff is female.
And they've recently switched to a more sustainable envelope to ship seeds. Their new mailers are completely recyclable, made of paper and a cushioning material that is specifically designed to easily separate from the paper fibers during the repulping and recycling process.
They're also longtime members and supporters of the Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association and signers of the Safe Seed Pledge, promising to never knowingly sell any GMO seeds. They do germination testing throughout the year on every single seed variety they carry, so they can stand behind their viability guarantee.
Pine Tree Garden Seeds is meant for every level of expertise, for the yard artists, the backyard growers, the herb explorers, the bouquet builders, the habitat curators, and beyond. They're committed to helping you get the most out of your home garden by providing high-quality garden seeds, plants, and supplies at an affordable price. Get your spring garden going today by ordering your seeds from superseeds.com and using our promo code GOODDIRT2024 for 20% off your entire order. That's SUPERSEEDS.com with our code GOODDIRT2024.
You know, the real downfall was we had an opportunity to open a little store. So all was kind of going well. And I took on a business partner and she really kind of started to take over the operations because I had to get another job. And we opened this little store, which to me was like kind of the dream because the idea was that people would after work stop in and then this classic, you know, 5 p.m. what the heck am I going to make for dinner blank would be where we came in and said, okay, here, take these five items and make this curry. Take these five items and make, you know, this chicken dish. Take these five items and do this. So we were really trying to take that same idea of the box and bring it to this kind of mini store and just help people use fresh seasonal produce, but actually make a meal and just like go finish the stories. But that just wasn't in a good location. Wasn't enough foot traffic. And we kind of like pouring our heart and soul into setting up this little shop. And due to this crazy long story, we actually didn't even have to pay rent for this little shop. We had some like special crazy weird deal. And it's still we lost money every week because there wasn't enough. The margins on produce is so small that the person sitting in the store was costing more than we were able to make. It sent me spinning of just like, how could this be? It was really kind of depressing and is what kind of derailed the whole thing. Learned a lot, but I think retail is, wow. I mean, we didn't even pay rent and it took us out. So it was crazy. Yeah. It was unfortunate. It was tough to have it happen so quick like that, but I think it's good to share because that's reality. Like you open a store and you expect like, great, people are going to come in, it's all going to work. And it's like, they could come in, but if it's not enough, and you don't have enough high margin items, the numbers aren't going to work. And it was really hard to watch that.
And people are so accustomed to things being a certain cost, cheap. Why would they go to this little store and buy this? And they can just run over to the supermarket and get it for less. And people aren't informed. They're not keyed into all this stuff. And they might think, oh, that place is too expensive. They're just making a bunch of money. And, you know, you hear that about CSAs, that it's too expensive. And, you know, we're here to tell people, you know, we need to unpack that a lot. We need to really open that up and look into that. And we do. We try to talk about that a lot on here. Like, is real food more expensive? Well, if you're looking at it, you know, through a certain lens, maybe you pay more at the time, but there's so much more cost, air quotes, down the road in terms of health and lifestyle and social impact and so many.
Yeah. And the question is like, who is paying that cost? Because someone is a long way or the earth is. And then the other side of it is, well, whose responsibility is it to pay it? I would love to steer kind of into your work in global supply chains and what you think of everything and kind of your experience of, you know, I guess starting especially in 2020 when the supply chain thing kind of became a big, people knew about. People were just starting to think about supply chains, I think, in a way that we didn't have to before. And of course, your experience with your business and everything and going into what you're doing now, as you mentioned earlier at the top of the conversation. Of course, you're writing your work that you're doing on your newsletter.
Starting with your trip in 2020, right before COVID, what did you see and what did you learn? I have so many questions about that. You know, the small farm versus the big commodity farms and organic and regenerative and who's doing what and why and are they making it work? And then you came back and that's when Farmbox came in, right?
Yep. Farmbox, yep.
What did you gather from that trip and the Farmbox experience that got you into the whole field you're in now and the writing about it?
Yeah, I mean, the trip and the Farmbox, I think about it maybe as like my Zoom in chapter where everything became more local. And now I'm kind of back to the Zoom out with the global and the food systems, especially in a lot of my writing. But I know that the kind of the number one thing I learned was just how hard it is to be a farmer, which I think I had picked up on, heard anecdotes, and really the skills that it takes to do it all, and mechanic, accounting, vet, all of it, soil scientist, just the deep, deep knowledge of chatting with people and having them walk me to their soil to show me the microbes and, you know, look at their machinery and talk about how they keep the maintenance on it. I mean, we went and visited sugarcane growers in Louisiana all the way to kind of wheat farmers in Kansas and rice grower in California. And I think that's what I really wanted to see were kind of these type commodity type crops that certain people were trying to kind of pull out of the commodity system, which is extremely difficult to do. But that deep respect led me to want to start Illuminate because the general thinking that if it takes this much work to grow the damn thing, excuse my language, how could anyone have a single ounce of energy to then sell it? Like, that's unfair. So having somebody growing something that's better, better for the environment, tastes better, you know, all of the things, somebody else needs to figure out how to sell it because that's also a skill. It's not as simple as just putting out a table in front of your house. That's not going to be enough. So getting that food and that produce into somebody's hands who can appreciate it was the piece that I wanted to take on. So that was kind of the motivation, was just meeting so many people who do such incredible stuff and then having it either get sucked into the commodity system and getting crap pay or, you know, putting it out there and not having a ton of love or customers, or especially with something that's so fragile and goes bad. So that was really the motivation. I think now where I am is just continuing to try and reach people in the importance of the food system and understanding the impact of what we eat, and not in a judgmental, you know, you need to do this, be a vegan type of way, in a really like, I didn't realize all of that has to happen to get you what I'm eating that I kind of just cook up and throw out in 30 minutes. So that's been, you know, how the work has pivoted to just try and see what resonates, which is really hard when you're creating content because a lot of times you don't hear back. And you don't know what might influence someone or be interesting. So at this point, my work is kind of divided between like a think piece or an essay about something I find fascinating in supply chains, which based on our social media model is just not going to be that thing that someone's drooling over or, oh, wow, or I'm going to share this.
Not exactly viral content.
Yeah, not exactly viral content. Exactly. Which is why I've also gotten obsessed with recipes, because that to me is this direct vessel. So that is where I straddle now. And I do love them both. I think, you know, creating recipes, making food and taking pictures of it is also a wild combination of skills and photography and all this stuff that is an uphill learning curve, but they both feel important. And I continue to find myself like stuck between two worlds again, where it's like, oh, I don't want to just be a viral recipe content creator because that feels empty inside. And if you're a food writer, you're kind of sometimes in a small echo chamber, just like talking
about
sustainability.
You're talking to people who like care and agree with you.
That's the idea now, is try and keep a foot in both worlds. I've always been saying that it really blew my mind that I think I would talk about like zero waste on Instagram. Like there was this virality to zero waste influencers, but to me, there's still the food world on social media is still very one note. And it does surprise me. It's very much food porn, yum, quick hacks. It doesn't have that depth. And I think somehow the plastic free movement, the zero waste, was really able to bring to people's attention. So I'm still kind of waiting and like, is this sustainability kind of food, climate change? Can we combine that with recipes and eating and food really without it just being like the boring side road that everybody is avoiding?
I really like that you use the word depth, because that catches my attention, because I feel like that's so needed in this whole food discussion and this whole supply chain discussion and the climate issues associated with our diets. I think we can all agree that a diet that, you know, includes lots of plants is really good. But I love to go in that more deeply. You have an essay on your website entitled, "Does Being Resourceful Lead to Destruction?" And I think you've hit on something so essential, is that as humans, we are innovative, we're ingenious, but sometimes our solutions create problems.
Yeah, writing things like that and thinking about them can lead you really to like an existential crisis of this problem of human innovation leading to destruction, because it is everything we've done and ever done. And, you know, straddling the climate crisis movement and just observing the type of solutions in quotes that are being floated, it's very scary, because I do think people believe that we can invent our way out of this. And what I featured in that piece was this parasol, basically a giant umbrella that people are proposing we put out into space that can direct some rays of sun elsewhere. And I think somebody sees something like that and it's like, okay, great, the scientists are on it, I don't have to worry, it's all going to be fine. And that's not what I believe is where we should be heading. And I think we are in this seesaw time of having gone so far into global trade and globalism and commodity economy and convenience that we're at like an end of the road, not to be dramatic about it, but innovating our way out of it while sliding back on a lot of those achievements is really confusing. So I think that's what's so interesting about this time. And in specifically our food, there's so much coming out of Singapore of just like indoor vertical farming and cell-based agriculture and plant-based meat that uses such little water, but so far people don't really want to eat it. So this is where we're stuck. It's like we can have all these innovations. To me, it's the opposite of like renewable energy. It's like, okay, great, renewable energy, put it in the grid. No one even really knows what the heck's going on. They're turned on their lights. They're doing their thing. Change accomplished. Incredible. Food is a decision that people make again and again and again. Unless there's some sort of like mandatory policy, which would never fly, it actually has to be something somebody wants. So offering up a solution like a cell-based meat or a plant-based meat is not enough. So right now we're kind of stuck in a lot of money being poured into these things, but showing very little consumer interest and consumer demand. So I think that the jury is certainly out whether that can change. But to me, what's interesting is what is it about the individual consumer that encourages them to change? Because at this point, all the doom and gloom about climate change, that doesn't work. So what is it that connects with someone to want to eat a little bit differently. Is that necessary? I believe yes. Who's telling them that it's necessary? Is it a trusted source? So when they believe, and what are the other options? Do they feel good? Do they align with the nutrition guidelines that they believe they need to eat? Is it accessible? Is it tasty? All of these things. So it's, you know, these big, big global issues really do boil down to individual consumer decisions with the help of other things. But that's become kind of an obsession for me because there is so much happening behind the scenes that is innovation. But when it comes down to, you know, what are we eating for dinner? It really, you fall back on the stuff most inherent to you. It's like not the time to really innovate at 6 p.m. after a day of work. It's, I have this chicken in the freezer. I have this mac and cheese, you know, the easy stuff that we're used to. So that's kind of where my focus has been. And that's why, I mean, I think spotlighting soybeans is, you know, why I love to write these things, because it's something no one thinks about. Nobody really realizes how omnipresent it is in our food system. The same with high fructose corn syrup. What's the deal with that? Why that came from wheat and wheat subsidies? You know, what is vegetable oil? All these things, and which ties into the innovation leading to destruction. It's like we figured out how to use every little piece of these commodity crops. And it's not just when you're creating the soybean oil, you're throwing out the rest. We're feeding that to the animals. And that's, we are quite innovative. So this kind of like massive structure that's been built out to feed everybody is extremely efficient. And this is why people who work in it, or certain economists or whoever they are, get offended by these kind of local food ideologies. Cause it's like, are you kidding me? What it's taken in plant science, in fertilizers, in machinery, in all of this stuff to get us to the level where we are, there's no acknowledgement for that. And I've always kind of had this, I think my friends would call it a conservative streak of just like, this is actually incredible what has happened. Is it perfect? No, but it's a little too easy to just be like, screw all that. We need to eat local. Because that's just not a systemic approach to how this world is working currently. So I do have a deep appreciation and respect for these giant systems, as flawed as they are. So I think that that is something I've taken with me. I went to a liberal arts college and I was always confused, like people were protesting and they were angry. And it's like, there's a lot of hate for systems, but they're very impressive to me and worth acknowledging.
Where we would be without our system.
would not be in a great place. So I do try to kind of shine light on soybeans and wheat and corn and all of these things to critique from their current ways of operating. So a little bit of a tangent, but that's what I'm always trying to bring to the table.
Yeah, I love that. That's just so valuable. Yes, to hear that piece of it.
And I do, you know, I'll get things all the time like, oh, your mushroom meat, it's not local. Like, I'm not interested. Or, oh, you know, local, how can we grow food with just those food miles? Like, that's absurd. Like, there's critics on every side. And, you know, with the plant milks, it's like, oh, we can't have almond milk. It's too much water. And like, there's, everything's going to have a downside. It will make you crazy to try and do it perfect. So I think that famous saying, don't let perfect be the enemy of the good, really comes into place when it comes for food, because I think it ends up being a way for people to opt out. It's like, well, I'm not going to perfect, so I'm just going to have steak. Like, I can't deal with this. And the way our food system has so geniusly put so much space between animals and what's in the grocery store, it is so easy to just stay disconnected and stay kind of not bringing an investigative lens to your choices, because there's something wrong with the other choice. It's like, oh, well, that's not enough protein, or that's too much water, and all of that. So my approach is to not come at anybody. This is not a argumentative discussion. This is like a humane discussion around how we continue to live for generations eating real food. That's what I feel is at stake. Because if we don't figure out how to eat protein-rich, satiating meals without meat and without just a fake meat, then we're in trouble for ourselves, is how I feel. So it feels, it's a little bit at a fork in the road to me. It's like, if we don't figure this out at home in our kitchens with our own family and our own skill sets, then it might just be that 10 years from now, meat will actually be 10x the price, and we'll be stuck with kind of a plastic thing that looks like chicken, or a cell-based whatever it is, or something that is sad to think about. So that's what I do feel we're in for without adopting really more skills to cook plant-based meals. And it's an odd place to end up, but that is the end of the line for me.
Thank you for tuning in, calling in, and spreading the good dirt. We love hearing from you. You can reach our listener voicemail at 443-459-1950. That's 443-459-1950. You can find this number in our show notes and in our Instagram profile.
This show is produced by Lady Farmer, a slow living lifestyle community, and the original music is composed and performed by John Kingsley.
For more from Lady Farmer, follow us on Instagram at We Are Lady Farmer. That's We Are Lady Farmer. Or join us online at www.ladyfarmer.com. We'll see you next time on The Good Dirt.
Goodbye.